Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Li Pingchen, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Jialong Wu about his new book, Remapping the Contested Sinosphere, the Cross-Cultural Landscape and Ethnoscape of Taiwan. This book was published by Cambria in 2020. Jialong, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Liping, for your invitation to discuss my second book. It's an honor for me to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have this discussion with you. But first of all, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and maybe also about your research interest as well.
Of course. My name is Jialong Wu. I'm originally from Taiwan. I received my PhD degree in comparative literature from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2010, and later became a U.S. citizen in 2018. I'm currently a senior lecturer in the Department of Global Cultural and Language Studies at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. I relocated to this sheep farming country from the United States in 2019. Before my relocation, I served as an associate professor of Chinese studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. My research interests are Taiwan literature and film. It is why I always identify myself as a Taiwan-focused scholar. After I published my first book, Supernatural Sinophone Taiwan and Beyond in 2016, I was planning to expand my research scope and study the narratives of abnormalities. The potential topics include the literary and cinematic representation of the ghostly, monstrous, mad, eccentric, sickened, and disabled subjects. You can say I have a very weird taste for artistic forms. It is probably the reason why I'm always fascinated by the narrative of the strange. However, I decided to switch the topic of my second monograph to the cross-cultural landscape and ethnoscape of literary Taiwan. Ethnicity is undoubtedly a critical discourse in Taiwan studies, given that Taiwan has long been a multi-ethnic island state that includes groups such as indigenous people, 原住民, native people, 本省人, mainlanders, 外省人, and other immigrant settlers. Each ethnic group has specific cultural baggage and shared memories. The tricky thing is, each ethnic group can never work as a standalone, while it is impossible to bypass the interaction or conflict among these groups. The inter-ethnic struggle and compromise actually occupy an important place in my second book. To me, the Taiwanese history of pain revolves around the ethnic issue, as I mentioned earlier. Thanks to the scholar grant awarded by the Jiang Jingguo Foundation, I was given a sabbatical to finish the draft of the book manuscript right before I came to New Zealand, where I further polished the work and got it published in late 2020. I'm deeply grateful for the warm support from the Jiang Jingguo Foundation and the University of Canterbury. My special thanks also extend to Cambria Press, which is a great academic publisher to work with. To be honest, I'm quite happy with the switch of the topic because now I feel that I'm making a stronger connection with my fellow scholars on Taiwan studies. Thank you.
Yeah, and then thank you for laying out your research journey, this different trajectory you take from your first book and now moving on to the second book about the history and also the literary history of Taiwan as well. And then especially you mentioned that Taiwan and then also the literary production, as you lay out in your, especially in your second book, there are different layers of legacies, different layers of influences, and also connection as well. So I think maybe now we can move on to the one of the layers, that is the Chinese legacy, and then connection, and also maybe some confrontation with China and the Chinese legacy as well. So can you tell us a little bit about Taiwan's link or confrontation with China in terms of history, culture, or political or linguistic connections?
Well, thanks for your question, Li Ping. That's indeed a thought-provoking question to answer. As a scholar in Taiwan studies, I am always interested in the cross-strait politics and its representation in Taiwan literature. Although I'm from a native Taiwanese family speaking Hokkien, I actually developed a Chinese fantasy for multiple reasons when I was much younger. On the wooden tablet for my family's ancestral worship, there is a name of the Chinese region I never visited in my whole life. Like many other Taiwanese people of my age, I was born during the martial law period of Taiwan and received a formal education focusing on Chinese history and geography, while Taiwan, our mother country, was simply treated as an insignificant province in school textbooks. I'm also a big fan of Jin Yong's Chinese martial arts fiction, in which an imaginary Chinese world is nicely portrayed. I carried this heavy Chinese cultural baggage to the United States, where I was eager to identify myself in a wonderland that feels strange to me. I have to say, I started learning, if not relearning, Taiwanese history in the United States. Taiwan's well noted for its colonial history of 400 years. The previous ruling powers of Taiwan include Spain, the Netherlands, late Ming Zhen regime, Imperial Qing, Japan, and the Kuomintang from China. In post-war Taiwan, Kuomintang or KMT oppressed the localist camp on the island by reinforcing an emotional tie with mainland China and further imposing its influence on the islanders across ethnic groups. With the rise of the Democratic Progressive Party, which is now the ruling party of Taiwan under the leadership of President Tsai Ing-wen, the so-called localist consciousness has long been clashing with the KMT-approved discourses of cultural China and Chinese diasporas. Under the DPP rule, Taiwan has developed a growing demand to cut political ties with Communist China and to become a freestanding political and cultural entity. However, Taiwan's pursuit of its unique cultural and political entity is severely challenged by the People's Republic of China, which represents the continuous pressure and threat to the island nation. With its military and economic powers, it's simply impossible to ignore the threat across the Taiwan Strait. So in this case, Taiwan's contested Chinese legacy has become a notable issue worthy of further discussion. The unpleasant political reality faced by Taiwan does not limit the development of the locally focused Taiwan literature. Instead, it propels more and more Taiwanese writers to rethink or deconstruct the Chinese legacy while exploring diverse aspects of the local community in literary creation. And the popularity of nativism and the post-nativism Taiwan literature is the best case in point. Still, Chinese legacy is dying hard and continues to serve as a critical topic in both political and literary arenas of Taiwan. When I was writing the book, my main concern was to investigate the issue of how official history intertwines with individual and ethnic memories of Taiwan. It is why each chapter of the book is linked with the old and new generations in various cultural contexts. In a profound way, Chinese legacy and Taiwanese consciousness negate each other because they represent two separate political systems and two separate cultural beliefs. China becomes a cultural necessity that confronts the Taiwanese subjectivity in the literary works I analyze. Ironically, the identity formulation of Taiwan cannot be completed without the evocation and then exorcism of Chinese ghosts from the past and present. We can observe this evolving trend in the works by Li An and Shi Shuqing, and by younger writers like Gan Yaoming and Yi Geyan. In the fourth chapter of the book, I bring into focus the connection between Taiwan's science fiction and the socio-political changes of the island state. In my analysis, Taiwan's science fiction takes on different issues of the island, including its marginalized position in the global network, ethnic and ideological divides in the domestic community, and the environmental crisis in a broad sense. On this matter, a truly local vision of science fiction can only be formed when the Chinese flavored sci-fi narrative is diluted or completely left behind. My research approach here is to deconstruct the ideological center of dominance and focus on the discourse of post-nativism in order to closely examine Taiwan literature from post-loyalist, post-colonial, and indigenous angles. Thank you.
Yeah, and I especially appreciate you laying out this different layer of connection. As you mentioned earlier, it could be ancestral connection and then also kind of like popular culture in terms of novels, literary works as well. And later on, you also share with us your research context as well in terms of this kind of official or national narrative of history versus the individual experience and individual story. And then particularly this case of the sci-fi fiction that how they use, reveal this connection that is being reimagined, and also the case for environmental crisis, the different approach to that, particularly in literary articulation as well. So now we talk about Taiwan's contested Chinese legacy, and then part of your book actually engage and also in conversation with the emerging field of Sinophone studies. So I guess now, can you tell us a little bit about just first, what is Sinophone studies?
Okay. Well, Sinophone studies is definitely a big topic to handle. I can try my best to answer the question. I still remember a few years back, I started using the term Sinophone at international conferences in Hong Kong and Seoul, South Korea. My use of the Sinophone theory was constantly challenged by Chinese essentialists in the audience. They simply could not understand the value of the Sinophone studies. So what is Sinophone studies? As we know, in 2004, Shi Shumei first coined the term Sinophone literature, literature written in Chinese by Chinese-speaking writers in various parts of the world outside China, in opposition to Chinese national literature. Shishume has been expanding the scope of the Sinophone over the years and created a theoretical discourse in the polyphonic and translocal light. To quote Shishume, the Sinophone is place-based local culture in dialogue with other cultures of that particular location. This critical lens translates to the unique translocality in each Chinese-speaking community and is thus separated from the one-dimensional Chinese-centered discourse. In this sense, the Sinophone has been widely adopted as an anti-hegemonic agenda and a symbolic break from the political dominance of China proper. Taiwan, Hong Kong, Mongolia, Xinjiang, Tibet, and Nanyang and the other diasporas can all be included in the discussion of the Sinophone world. Scholars like Sheldon Liu, however, have started to challenge the foundation laid by Shu Meishi and her allies and followers. According to Sheldon Liu, China must be included in the Sinophone discourse because, quote, the cinema, culture, history, languages, and dialects of mainland China abound with those of the periphery, end quote. As I argue in my book, whose focus on the Chinese link in the Sinophone world speaks to China's anti-separation anxiety in response to the ongoing calling for the local consciousness or independence. The ideological divide between Sheldon Liu and Shishume on the Sinophone discourse is not unlike the confrontation between the Chinese center and the peripheral big other. Another notable theory is presented by David Wei Wang, who identifies Taiwan as a critical hub of global Chinese literature in dialogue with China. Despite the political divide between China and Taiwan, David Wang identifies mainland China as the essential linguistic and cultural source for Taiwan. Personally, I would treat Wang's theory as the middle point between Shishume and Sheldon Liu. Like Sheldon Liu, David Wang recognizes the essential link between China and Taiwan. But in his theoretical design, Taiwan is not just the periphery, but serves as a cross-cultural hub that encompasses individual voices from within. His post-loyalist discourse is a good example in relation to our discussion here. Anyway, Shishume's celebration of the Sinophone undoubtedly challenges the grand Chinese narrative and grants access to different voices in the local communities. Sinophone studies turns out to be a very useful tool in reviewing the contemporary political issues observed in Chinese minor communities such as Xinjiang, Tibet, and even Hong Kong. Take Hong Kong for example. Hong Kong has faced unprecedented challenge in the past decade and is experiencing a complete political makeover under the national security law implemented by the Chinese government. Compared with Hong Kong, Taiwan has been developing a liberal view and a democratic system and trying to form diplomatic ties with other countries. The core of Taiwan's localist campaign happens to match the Sinophone spirit in response to area studies and global politics. The political trend of Sinophone Taiwan can also be found in Taiwan literature. As I mentioned earlier, I didn't start relearning Taiwan's literary history or history as a whole until I moved to the United States. Back then, I had a very limited understanding of Taiwan literature. I started reading the literary classics from Taiwan, including works by Bai Xianyong, Li Ang, Shi Shuqing, Zhu Tianwen, and Zhu Tianxin. Later, I was introduced to the fascinating Aboriginal narratives produced by both Han and indigenous writers. I do research on Taiwan literature and film, so it is natural for me to recognize the artistic endeavors to reconstruct and promote Taiwanese consciousness with a focus on the native soil and the experience. Personally, I found the Sinophone discourse promoted by Shi Shun and David Wang quite useful while I was writing my first and second books on Sinophone Taiwan. They said I owe intellectual debt to them and many other scholars in the field. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jiarong, especially for laying out the theorization, or I should say the different theorizations, responses, and also challenges to the Sinophone studies. And also you mentioned this key dimension for the translocality and localization, but also this anti-hegemonic principle in the theorization as well. And then especially appreciate that you mentioned that in relation to your research, how these different lenses can help you to explore and unpack the Taiwan's contemporary literary production. So that said, I guess the next question I have is actually to keep thinking about and exploring about Taiwanese-ness. And then we've been talking about the contested Chinese legacies in Taiwan. And later on, I believe we'll also be talking about other dimensions of the historical legacy and cultural connection as well. But now is to think about the Taiwanese-ness. And also in your book, you explore this diverse dimension and also plurality of Taiwanese-ness. So I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit about what is Taiwanese-ness? And then the also in your book, you mentioned this culturally hybrid ethnoscape and multifaceted cultural expression in Taiwan.
Sure. So what is Taiwanese-ness? To be honest, I don't have a clear answer to a question myself, because the so-called Taiwanese-ness, Taiwanese identity, or Taiwanese subjectivity is being redefined, revised, and reconstructed by different political parties and ethnic groups with time. I think you are definitely right about pointing out the plurality of Taiwanese-ness, which occupies a critical place in my book. As a multilingual and a multi-ethnic island state, Taiwan is not limited to any singular essential culture. Instead, one can see in Taiwan the culturally hybrid ethnoscape that can be called home to various ethnic groups, be it mainlanders, native, or indigenous Taiwanese. To unpack the concept of Taiwanese-ness, I included Du Guoqing's definition of Taiwan literature in my second book. According to Du Guoqing, Taiwan literature expresses concerns with Taiwan and the life and destiny of its people in relation to society, culture, and history. Du Guoqing's words are connected with the nativist trend of Taiwan, which reached to significant milestones in the 1930s and 1970s, respectively. As Taiwan is growing into a community of diversity, Taiwan literature is enriched by a series of locally based writings focusing on specific places or the interaction between spaces. China, in this case, is no longer the focal point. What contemporary Taiwanese writers bear in mind is the interplay of place space in formulating a new identity to be imposed on the local community and beyond. Simply put, it is impossible to identify Taiwan and from one angle only, because the history and culture of Taiwan is made up of the conflicts and compromises between nations, races, and ethnicities. As for the multifaceted cultural expressions of Taiwan, this book takes into account Taiwan's entanglement with cultural China, Chinese diasporas, nativist trend, and Aboriginal consciousness. For many years, Taiwan really has a hard time forming a discourse of its own while being in the shadows of the oppressive Chinese nation state and the overarching Chinese civilization. On this matter, a critical approach to Taiwan's identity construction is remembering and reclaiming its indigenous history. After I moved to New Zealand, I was awed by the New Zealand government's clear political agenda to honor the history and the cultural legacy of Maori indigenous people, so as to create or recreate a national identity shared by all New Zealanders, despite the fact that the majority of Kiwis are of European descent. It is intriguing to see Taiwan under DPP's rule has been taking a similar route in recent years. What is more exciting to note here is the discovery of the genetic link between Taiwan's indigenous people and New Zealand's Maori people. About 5,000 years ago, a group of indigenous people in Taiwan traveled by sea and were intermarried with people living on the Pacific Islands. Their descendants eventually settled in New Zealand. New Zealand-based biologist Dr. Jill Gray Chambers has scientifically proven that indigenous Taiwanese are actually the living ancestors of Maori people in New Zealand. This new finding, in my view, liberates Taiwan from the traditional Chinese historiography and reinstates the possibility for Taiwan to forge a strong link with other cultures and regions. In my second book, I did try to cover multiple aspects of the reconstructed Taiwanese subjectivity through the lens of Sinophone Taiwan. Over the five interrelated chapters, I engage with such critical terms as localization, bentuhua, nativism, xiangtuzhuyi, post-loyalism, houyiminzhuyi, indigeneity, yunzhuminxing, and translocality, kuadixing. What I'm highlighting here is an all-inclusive view of ethnicity and identity for all the people living in the island nation, including native people, mainlanders, indigenous people, and Xinzhuming, which refers to the new immigrants from the 1990s onward. Of course, what I present in the book are selected topics and groups, and the list can certainly be expanded with the inclusion of more cultural expressions of Taiwan. Thank you.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. And then especially totally agree with you that it's hard, right? It's hard to define what is Taiwanese-ness, and especially this identity or this conceptualization is still evolving and becoming. I guess partly that's why it's so very exciting to, you know, explore and also to examine this process of becoming Taiwanese. And also thank you for laying out the different aspect of Taiwanese-ness in terms of ethnic, in terms of cultural, and also linguistic as well. And then thinking about in a way that China is no longer the focal point or no longer the only focal point of cultural formation and also political identification. So with that said, we discussed the contested Chinese legacy, and then now I would like to move on to another layer of legacy and also the chapter of history as well, that is about Japan. In your book, one of the chapters is about Japan, and then particularly through these approach of post-loyalism. So I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit about what is post-loyalism first?
Okay, I can try. My understanding of post-loyalism largely came from my reading of David Wong, who persistently emphasizes the unique cultural status of Taiwan in negotiation with China. Historically speaking, the majority of the Taiwanese population are the descendants of the Han Chinese migrant settlers. Both native people and mainlanders share the fundamental cultural roots, but there is a widening gap between the two groups in terms of linguistic expression and colonial experience. While native people are the descendants of the earlier migrants to Taiwan hundreds of years ago, mainlanders refer to the Chinese people who retreated to Taiwan together with Chiang Kai-shek and his KMT army in the late 1940s. Under the political control of the KMT regime, Taiwanese people were educated, if not forced, to adopt a pro-China agenda for many, many years. In post-war Taiwan, Taiwan literature was dominated by the discourses of anti-communism and Chinese diasporas, both of which were officially approved and celebrated by the Chinese nationalist government in Taiwan. This China complex indeed plays a key role in shaping Taiwan literature in the 20th century. In Wong's analysis of post-loyalism, there are three types of people: immigrants, foreigners / colonized subjects, and loyalists. Taiwan showcases a profound mix of these three people, or the three peoples, in the post-loyalist sense. In other words, Wong's post-loyalist discourse of Taiwan reacts to the collective nostalgia and anxiety towards China as an imagined homeland. My research on Taiwan literature clearly benefits a lot from Wong's post-loyalist theory, but I would like to expand the scope by including a scholarly discussion on Japan complex in Taiwan's literary writings. It is ironic, but in the meantime understandable, to observe that Taiwan, as a former colony, has gradually forged a strong bond with its colonizer, Japan, despite Japan's mass killings of Taiwanese people in the first half of the colonial period. Taiwanese people once celebrated Japan's surrender and their return of China to return of Taiwan to China in 1945. But the local people's happiness did not last, due to the political segregation between mainlanders and other ethnic groups. Gradually, Taiwanese people started to express their preference for the colonial setting under Japan over the impotent rule of the KMT, which was responsible for the economic issues and ethnic divides in post-war Taiwan. To many Taiwanese people, the KMT government was nothing but another colonial regime replacing the previous one. There was a popular slogan to describe the situation of the time. People used to say "gao qi di lai" in Taiwanese dialect, or "can" or "go qi zhu lai" in Mandarin, which means "the dogs go and the pigs come." While Japanese colonizers are compared to dogs of some practical use, the Chinese mainlanders are good for nothing. There are other factors such as the February February 28th incident and the white terror during the martial law period. Long story short, Japan has been identified by the localist camp and the ruling party of Taiwan as a potential partner in the international community. Intriguingly, the pro-Japan narrative works as a proper solution for Taiwan to escape from the persistent China-centric discourse in a profound process of decolonization. If the post-loyalist focuses on the loss of a previous dynasty or political regime and turns its absence into presence of our time, both China and Japan should be included in the discourse of post-loyalism. In the first chapter of the book, I focus on Li An's and Shi Shuqing's novels. While rethinking the post-loyalist discourse, it would be helpful if we review Shi Shuqing's Taiwan trilogy, including Walking Through Luojing, Xing Guo Luojing, Dust in the Wind, Feng Qian Cheng Ai, and the People of Three Generations, San Shi Ren. It is clear that Shi Shuqing deals with multiple cultural memories across Taiwan's chaotic times. Shi Shuqing takes into account both the Chinese diasporic and Japanese colonial experiences. Dust in the Wind, for example. In the novel, Shi employs the image of Wanse, which means Taiwanese-born Japanese. In my opinion, Shi Shu's inclusion of a Wanse helps us rethink and expand the post-loyalist discourse of Taiwan in the 21st century. It is also the goal I want to achieve with the first chapter of the book. Thank you.
Thank you. And especially this example about Shi Shuqing's writing and then the focus on Wanshan and then this kind of like the complicated process of decolonization in Taiwan, where Japan complex, as you lay out in the book, this kind of like a sense of loss, nostalgia, and also attachment still, in some contexts, still strongly felt. So for this is the Japanese connection and also the colonial legacy and historical context as well. So there's another layer in the Taiwanese-ness and also the Taiwan literature as well, that is the indigenous voices and indigenous experience. So in your book, you mentioned that you analyze greatly in terms of the reconstruction of indigeneity in literary production. So can you tell us a little bit about how the indigenous writers, they developed and reclaim or represent the indigenous consciousness in their work? And also, that's for indigenous writer, but we also see some of the Han Chinese writer or directors, they also try to approach and understand and also represent the indigenous voices in their works. So can you tell us a little bit about the representations?
Well, thank you for the question. I have to emphasize that this chapter plays a very important role in the overall design of the book. I think the book would not be complete without the presence of indigenous voices. Because as I emphasized earlier, Taiwan plays a critical role in the global indigenous studies thanks to its genetic and cultural links with the Pacific Islanders and the Maori people in New Zealand. Although indigenous people of the 16 officially recognized tribes only account for about 2% of the Taiwanese population, the indigeneity of Taiwan served to identify the island state as a unique political and cultural entity. Though contested by Communist China, which never stopped trumpeting its One China policy. On the one hand, Taiwan's indigeneity represents the alternative cultural reality required to separate the island nation from China proper. On the other, Taiwan is given access to the enlarging Austronesian and Polynesian networks through its indigenous history and culture. It is clear that DPP government fully understands the importance of Taiwan's indigeneity. In 2016, President Tsai Ing-wen issued an official apology to Taiwan's indigenous people who were persecuted and suffered in various colonial settings. In recent years, more and more Taiwanese writers have started to recognize the cultural significance of Taiwan's indigenous identity, and thus include indigenous characters and voices in their works. In the third chapter of my book, I try to examine how Aboriginal and indigenous narratives are represented in Taiwan literature. I first surveyed the literary works by famous indigenous writers such as Topas Tamapima or Tian Yage, Hasnuman Vava, Wang Xinming, and Rubas Nagil, Tian Mingzhong. Overall, indigenous writings tend to focus on the living conditions of Aboriginal peoples in the past and the present, covering the issues of discrimination and assimilation faced by these marginalized ethnic groups. Other important topics include critical divides between Aborigines and Hans, between nature and society, and between tribal communities and the modern state. In many indigenous literary accounts, the Aboriginal subjects are continuously disheartened as they witness the decline of their tribal traditions and hunting grounds. In this light, these Aboriginal subjects are cast as strangers, if not subhumans, in a Han Chinese-dominated society. To confront the Han-centric narrative, indigenous writers formulate a self-conscious writing strategy with the introduction of mountain and sea writing, or Shanghai Shuxie in Mandarin. Under this design, natural space is profoundly linked with the indigenous heritage in Taiwan, as the indigenous writing associates the homeland and the people living on it. It echoes the ongoing nativist campaign in relation to a place-based writing strategy within the Sinophone framework. While it is important to see how Taiwan's indigenous writers reclaim and represent their own history and culture, we can also benefit from observing the evolving trends of the written accounts provided by Han Chinese writers in Taiwan. As a matter of fact, the Han-centric view persisted for hundreds of years and was widely held by Chinese migrant settlers. In the introduction of the General History of Taiwan, Taiwan Tongshi, the author Lian Heng chronicles Taiwan's historical progress in a China-centric light and excludes the Aborigines as if they are unworthy, uncivilized subjects in the history of Taiwan. In this chapter, I highlighted the publication of Lai He's poem, Southern Territory Lament, Nanguo Aige, which recognizes the Sidek warriors' practice of head hunting during the Wuxi incident as an act of a cultural resistance against the Japanese colonization. Lai's poem interestingly blurs the line between Han and indigenous subjects in Taiwan from an anti-colonial, pro-nationalist perspective. The Aborigines' identity is transformed from savages to brothers of the Han Chinese people on the island. Unfortunately, Taiwan's indigenous people had to endure another setback or exclusion in both society and in literature under the KMT control. In the past two decades, the inclusion of indigenous subjects can be widely observed in the Taiwan-focused narrative produced by Han writers. The cases I study in the chapter are Gan Yaoming's Killing Ghost Sha Gui and Bang Cha Girl, Bang Cha Nu Hai. Both novels stage indigenous subjects and promote fluid notion of indigenous consciousness beyond ethnic, cultural, and religious differences. I use the term coexistence to highlight the correlation between indigenous and Han Chinese subjects, as demonstrated in Gan Yao Ming's fiction. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jarong. And then especially thinking about this reconstruction and also this kind of emerging indigenous voices, and also how we have been seeing a lot of works and also about a lot of writing about their experience and voices as well. And then especially to sort of kind of disrupt the Sino-centered narrative, and then in order to explore and connect to the oceanic network. So this oceanic network, so I guess my next question would be also kind of like about oceans. So this kind of trans-Pacific aspect as well. So one of your chapters actually talk about Taiwanese American writers. And then so can you tell us a little bit about how do Taiwanese writers write about Taiwan? And then how do they understand the family history or Taiwan's history through this kind of mediated memory, or some of them actually understood by some of their archival research, so on and so forth. And then also how the Sinophone spaces is constructed or recreated in their Anglophone writing.
Well, thank you. In the fifth and the last chapter, I stretch my research in the field of Taiwan literature by analyzing three English language novels, Francie Lin's The Foreigner novel, Julie Wu's The Third Son novel, and Shana Yang Rai's Green Island. The inclusion of Taiwanese American writers in my book on Sinophone Taiwan is certainly an experimental move. The draft of this chapter actually received both positive and negative comments. Traditionally, Taiwanese American literature fits in the category of Asian American literature or serves as a subcategory of Chinese American literature. What intrigues me the most is how the three Taiwan-based novels intersect with Taiwan's literary and political trends, while revisiting the troubled past and the present of the island state. All the three English language novels center around the micro history of individual families in response to the macro history of Taiwan in the 20th and 21st centuries. Although these novels are written in English, they share the same interest in recreating the political and the cultural spaces of Taiwan and reviving the collective memory of Taiwanese people and their extended families across the Pacific Ocean. This chapter aims to provide a new angle on Huaren or ethnic Chinese by going beyond the umbrella term and elaborating on the contested concept of writing Taiwan. In doing so, reviewing Taiwanese American literature is an important part of examining the Taiwan-based writing strategy across the Pacific. These three novels trace the historical and political turmoil of Taiwan from the Japanese colonial period to the contemporary era. One critical historical moment, which all three literary works include is Taiwan's February 28th incident in 1947, which is a landmark event in the modern history of Taiwan. Since the lifting of the martial law, a number of Taiwanese writers have been promoting the local subjectivity through the production and reproduction of Taiwan's historical trauma. This strategy is also developed in Taiwanese American writing. Among the three novels, Shana Yang Rai's Green Island has undoubtedly earned the most scholarly interest because it is the first English novel to focus on Green Island as a symbolic site of political imprisonment. On a deeper level, Green Island also points to Taiwan's identity as a contested island nation overshadowed by the overpowering Chinese state. As I argue in the chapter, Ryan also brings into focus the ideological conflict between the China-centric view and the localist agenda. It details former President Chiang Kai-shek's declaration to Taiwanese people after the February 28th incident, and how he warns that Taiwanese people must recognize their duty to the fatherland, China, and should not perform any rash and thoughtless acts which will be harmful not only to our country, but also to themselves. In response to Chiang Kai-shek's political statement, Ryan offers counter perspectives by including Taiwanese writer Huang Shihui's Taiwan-focused view in relation to Taiwanese sky, Taiwanese ground, Taiwanese time, and Taiwanese language. Even though her novel is written in English, Ryan has answered Huang's call for a Taiwan-centered experience in literary works. Some may argue that these English novels are not local or authentic enough to represent Taiwanese-ness. Yet, we should keep in mind that these novels not only offer new ways of viewing and writing Taiwan from across the Pacific Ocean, but also make this contested island nation more accessible to the English-speaking world. Given that translocality is a necessity in every Sanfon community, it would be a pity if we exclude such Taiwan-based and Taiwan-focused English novels in the scholarly discussion on Sinophone Taiwan. I think that concludes my answer to the question. Thank you.
Yeah, and then especially appreciate this introduction and also examination of the diaspora, their experience and also memory, and also maybe reformation or transformation of the Taiwanese identity across generation and also in diasporic context, and then especially in another linguistic system, in this case, Anglophone English writing as well.
Yes.
So we've been talking about, specifically three chapters, and then briefly you mentioned the sci-fi chapter, and there's also one chapter about eco-critical discourse in global network. And for the interest of time, we might not be able to dwell into that chapter, but definitely recommend our listeners to check it out. So we've been taking a lot of your time, and so now... last question. So this is a traditional question here at New Books Network. So Jialong, can you share with us what you are working on right now, or what your next project will be?
Okay. First of all, I do hope that I will find the time to revisit my previous project on the strange figures in Taiwan literature and film. But I need to focus on some other projects at the moment. I just initiated my third book project entitled Taiwan Literature in the 21st Century, which is a volume co-edited by Professor Fan Mingru from National Chengchi University and me. This edited collection is under contract with Springer. Dr. Fan and I are collecting chapter proposals from international scholars. We plan to survey the evolving trends of literary Taiwan and promote the translocal awareness and cultural diversity of the island nation through the book project. The potential topics include, but are not limited to, post-nativism, indigenous writing, eco-criticism, gender and queer studies, and localization and globalization. We will include around 16 chapters in the book. Each chapter will be around 6,000 words long and function as an independent research essay dedicated to a specific Taiwanese writer. It is our belief that this edited volume will make a great contribution to the current scholarship of Taiwan and Sinophone studies. In addition to the co-author introduction, I will contribute one chapter on Xiaman Lan Bo'an to the volume. The deadline for the proposed proposal submission is November the 1st, 2021, which is this coming Monday. So I would like to take this opportunity to give a last push for call for chapters proposals. And Liping, you have cordially invited to submit a proposal if you are interested. And for the general listeners of this podcast, you may consider to submit a proposal as well. Besides, I have some other smaller projects going on, but I need to spend more time organizing my thoughts and reading notes before those projects take shape. Thank you.
Thank you, Jaron, and especially for the kind invitation to me and also to our audience for your book project. So I know the deadline is coming up. And then if our audience, you are listening to this episode after past the deadline, you know, still feel free to, you know, contact or email Jaron. Just keep, you know, in touch. And then about this very interesting and I believe very important book project about contemporary Taiwan literature.
Well, thank you.
So thank you, Jaron, again for talking with us and then for being on the show today. I really enjoy the conversation and also your introduction and also analysis, the cases that you introduced to us today.
Well, thank you, Liping.
So, yeah, so thank you, our audience, too, for listening to the episode today. And then I hope you all take care. And then we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.